All right, Dr. Mark, we're ready to start. We'll welcome everybody. Erev Tov, I know you always like to say the date, but February 6, 2023, the first of our new series, Letters of the Rav, that Dr. Shapiro has discovered and he'll share with us over the next number of weeks. And I want to thank Rabbi Mayor Bruckheimer for sponsoring this evening's shiur. As you may have heard, his grandson got married last week, Tzvi Silver to Rivka Grob. We want to wish him Mazel Tov. Many happy occasions. All have many happy occasions. And thank you for sharing your simcha with all of us. Okay, Dr. Shapiro, it's all yours.
Okay, thank you. And hold on, my other computer set here. Rabbi mentioned, we're starting a new series here. I'll give an introduction and I'll explain what led me to this. And I see that we have a nice crowd here, so people are interested in the Letters of the Rav. But although it is a new series, I don't think our regulars will be upset. I do have a few comments still from last week, so I'll say that and then we'll begin. But is Rabbi Hartman with us? Because I want to thank, I mean, he reminded me of Rabbi Soloveitchik's doctoral dissertation subject. I always forget whether it's Max Scheller who he wrote about, but here I have a copy of it. I got a copy many years ago. Here it is. You see it's Joseph Soloveitchik. I can send anyone this if you read German. It's not very long, it says from Prujana. That's Prujan. That's his father was the rabbi there. No, his father was the rabbi in. That's where his mother, his grandfather was, right? I forget now as well. Wait a second. His father was in Rasayn and Chaslovitz. So why he calls it Prujan, that's from his mother's side, I'm not sure. Maybe that's something to do with the politics. That's sort of Eliyahu Prujaner, the Eliyahu Feinstein. And it says the oral exam is on the 24th of July and the date of promotion is the 10th of December. In Germany, you have to publish your dissertation. You just would take it and you find a little publisher. Now, I'll get back to, I'll talk about my archives and the things I find and how I came to the letters. But one of the very first things I found was when it was still East Germany, they found from the University of Berlin all of Soloveitchik's materials, the evaluations, letters of his, evaluations from his professors, his diploma even. And I learned also then not to give my stuff away because I gave it to Manfred Lehmann. And you could read his article. It's online. It was in the Allgemeiner Journal, Rewriting a Biography of the Rav. And it's a whole thing there, but I'm never mentioned. And yet I gave it to him. Because I had met him and he asked me, he never told me he was going to publish it. He published it without mentioning me. He even says at the bottom here, the Rav's diploma in Latin. Yeah, he says the fact that his information is still housed in Berlin where I got the copy, which is not true. I gave him the copy. And, I was a kid then, and what did I know? I gave him this stuff. I thought that I'd get some kavod. He'd write in the Allgemeiner about me and something. And so now that was the first example of things I discovered, and I'll tell you all about what I discovered and how I came to the letters. But I have all these things, and I can talk about them as well. But I want to share a few other things with you just before we begin, because they're related to last week. First, we spoke about the pioneer. I'm actually, those who are with me, I took out in the audio the comment that we all heard because I don't think it should be on for Modoros. But here's from the Jewish Observer in the 1960s, 65. And remember, there's no hashgacha on the pioneer. And it says here, now they got kosher meat, Chol of Yisrael, so it's coming in. Notice it says the new pool, $100,000 Tropicana pool with three decks for sunning, relaxing. Now, I want to tell you that there was no such thing as separate swimming then, even though this was the hotel that all the Gedolim went to. The concept didn't even exist, and I knew that, and I heard that from the grandson. But then I showed him the ad, and I said to him, but no, they did have indoors. They did have separate swimming. Notice it says health club, steam room, indoor swimming pool, separate hours for men and women. Just not on the outside. Of course, today they wouldn't go to the place, even if it was outside. But so he replied to me as follows, that I'm actually, it's incorrect, that he says, the indoor pool was part of the health club. It was very Russian, no bathing suits. So that's why at the Pioneer, it was separate swimming. Now, we got, why we get into the Pioneer, which some of you remembered well, it was because I was speaking about places that don't have hashgacha, and yet everyone trusted them. And I spoke about Simcha by the Sea. I spoke about this place in the Catskills into the 80s, but I thought that this was part of the lost history of American Orthodoxy, that other than Chabad, no one today could do this. It would be impossible. And I mentioned how there's takanot now in cities, and Rabbi Yonah Reis in the latest Journal of Halakha and Society talks about how this is absolutely forbidden. You can't do it. And not that they made takanot and now it's forbidden, but basically that it's forbidden. That's why they made the takanot. I want to show you something which I heard from Tzvi. He contacted me and then I confirmed it, which I had no idea about. Those in Brooklyn might know this place, Lieberman's Dairy Luncheonette, which I'm told that basically everyone eats there, including the Hasidim, although he said some Hasidim won't. This, as we speak now, in February of 2023, this place is not under Hashgacha. There is no Hashgacha. And everyone eats in this place in Borough Park. But what makes it incredible, I think even more incredible, maybe this is the reason why, as he says, not all Hasidim will eat there, but most do, is it's run by a modern Orthodox couple from Staten Island. I think we have their picture here. Maybe not. Maybe one of the other aunts had it, had their picture in it. But this is a place you can go there. And so it's not ancient history. It's not. It's in Borough Park as we speak. And I see it's not only Chabad. You still have a place.
It's a vestige of old Borough Park. That is correct. Yes.
And it's been grandfathered in, I guess you could say. So next time I'm in Borough Park, I'm going to have to go check it out. My son, Amir Tzashem, one of our listeners, who's a Rav and a Dayan, he's actually hosting my son this Shabbos, and another YU guy and friend of my son in Borough Park. So maybe they can go check it out. So what's the? Well, I was thinking about this because this reminded me of something. Let me close this for a second. This reminded me of something because we're going to deal later with Rabbi Sorrell, with the Musar movement. And Rabbi Sorrell Salanter actually deals with this. In his famous Igeres HaMusar, he says as follows. He gives an example of what the problem of Jews in his day, 19th century Europe, was. And he says that he speaks with people, mochrei basar kasher. That is, it wasn't just that you had people who would bring the chicken to the shochet and he'd shecht it and you go home. There were people there shochtim who also shechted a bunch of chickens and then you went in and you'd buy it from them. And they didn't have mashkiach. The mashkiach was the Rav who knew how they knew how to shecht. And he had to show them their knives. But Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said that, he says that no one would dream that if any of these shochtim, the mochrei basar kasher, maybe if the shochet checked it, sometimes he'd sell it to someone and they prepare it to sell. He says that it would never happen, chalila. It would never arise. It would never occur to anyone who's selling kosher meat not to ask if a problem, if when they're looking, preparing the food, they find a chashash trefos, be'evarim apnimiyim, they would immediately go to the Rav and ask a shayla. In other words, there wasn't a mashkiach in the store, and there wasn't a mashkiach bin yotzer nechnas. But it was understood, and this is the mentality why you didn't need a mashkiach, because these are religious people, shechting, and they know that they would immediately go to the Rav to ask a shayla, even if he's going to lose a lot of money. There was never a chashash. Mora shamayim alav, betivo vehergolo, chagilavo. The chalil that he would hachshil sishal, so you didn't need hashkacha, you didn't need mashkiachim because there never was a havamina thought that someone. Remember, this is someone selling the meat to the people. But if in preparing it he sees a problem, there's now, today we have you can have a magid shir of dafyomi and munsi who could sell tarfus, mamish tarfus, not even a suffix on it. And but he, Rosh Hashanah Salanter says it would never even occur. So you can always rely on these people. But then he says, but the problem is that when it comes to masa umatan, it's the opposite. That is monetary things. Rov b'nei adam lo yidrushu achshash gezov oshak netzav. That's the whole point. He says that when it comes to ritual things, we can rely 100% on people. But when it comes to monetary matters and lashon hara and all that, then all of a sudden, they're not from anymore. And that's what really is the basis for Igeres HaMussar, why you need a Mussar movement, because the Jews have split the Torah. They've turned the Torah into ritualism. That is, and they're very mockpit on the ritual, but on the other parts, they're not mockpit at all. But I just find it's relevant to this issue we spoke about so much about the Hashkachas, because Rishon Solander testifies that we don't need to worry about this, because no, they never would try to take advantage of someone, but ironically, when it comes to other areas, they would. And finally, that reminds me. I mean, today, if you see someone going into a place that's maybe not up to the level of kosherus, and certainly if you saw someone going eating a McDonald's, he would definitely, you would not regard him as Orthodox, but he could be serving time for 100 years in prison for ripping everyone off, and yet when he gets out of prison, they'll give it a whole sudas mitzvah pinyon shvulim for him. So I think we might need Rabbi Sol Salanter again to stress these matters. And one final thing before we begin with Rav Soloveitchik, I feel I need to the great Rav Bernard Rachman. I need to. In fact, I didn't even show a picture of him. So let me hold on. Show a picture of this great individual. Well, there's many pictures, but let me hold on. Let me show you. Here you see Bernard Drachman. That's the famous picture of him. You see him when he's a little younger here. A very important Orthodox figure. And I said, and I told the story that he was given the money from Emmanuel to go the Reform Temple to go study in Germany. And he was studying actually in a school of theirs, that like a high school. But I said I think I said he had Reform background or something. It's really not true. He didn't have Reform. He had the way he describes his family, it's I guess you would call them traditional but not Orthodox. Like he says, for instance, they kept a kosher home, and he says that on the high holy days our store was closed. So on Shabbos, it's open, but it's closed on the high holidays. But there was on Pesach, they didn't have any leavened food. He says, I can't claim that our home conformed in every way to the precepts of Orthodox Judaism, but it did so in large measure. So he's like an old-fashioned East European Jew where they're not Shomer Shabbos and not exactly Orthodox, but not Reform. And they had a kosher home, which a Reform family wouldn't have. And he could have gone the Reform route, but he didn't, and he actually becomes completely what we would call Orthodox. So I apologize for any descendants of Rabbi Drachman, perhaps, for implying that, but it wouldn't have been a problem. I mean, it would have been even a more amazing story if he actually came from a complete Reform background and became who he became. So with this, we move on now to our next unit. We've been doing this now since the beginning of COVID. I think this will probably be 3 classes. I don't think more, but if it goes to 4, it's okay. This is the letters of the Rav that I found and published in the last issue of Hakira. So I want to tell you a little bit about introduction, how I came to these letters. Then we're going to go through them, and then we'll talk about what I think are significant in these letters. For those who've been with us for so long, even just a couple of years, obviously the ones who've been here for many years, it wouldn't surprise you if I told you that for many years now I've been looking through archives. I've been finding things. I can say more than 35 years I've been involved in archives. Archives of individuals, archives of institutions. I've traveled all over the world for that. Fortunately, I was able to get funding from various places. That my book on Rabbi Chaim Yaakov Weinberg couldn't have been written if I was doing it today, because half the letters are lost. But I was able to go to people's children and people, and they let me into basements and look, and I found, Baruch Hashem, many things. And I published some of them. If you go on my academia page, you can find some pieces from this journal that comes out of Flatbush called Hamashbir. It's an annual, actually. I published pieces dealing with Frankfurt Orthodoxy, from the Rugachever archive. Oh, lots of stuff. I think maybe my next Hebrew volume is I'll collect a lot of the letters. I have hundreds and hundreds of unpublished letters of Gedolim, and I could put them in a nice volume. So that's for the future. But for now, let's talk about the Rav. So I never started looking for things from Rav Soloveitchik. But as I'm looking through archives, here and there, for the last 35 years, I would find a letter here, find a letter there, and I just kept them, and I have a nice file. And lo and behold, just last year, for some reason, it hit me, why don't I publish these? The reason I thought that is because I also have some articles, believe it or not, from Rav Soloveitchik that he published that no one knows about. I mean, they're published, but they've been totally forgotten. And I will be revealing them soon enough. But one of these things I found, Tradition, a few issues ago, published, I had a transcript of sorts of a talk the Rav gave at one of the Mizrahi conventions. And I was preparing it, actually, for publication. It was in Hebrew. Someone transcribed it in Hebrew, although he gave the talk in Yiddish. Lo and behold, Tradition actually got a copy of the Rav's actual manuscript from the house, and they published it. And it's the same thing I had, but in more detail. So then I started thinking that maybe someone's going to find some of these letters, because it's not like I found them. Most of them come from public archives. You just have to know to look. But you never know. And these days, people are putting everything online. So if I don't get it up soon, maybe it's going to be online, and then it's no big deal anymore. Everyone can find it. I took a few months. I transcribed them. The English handwriting is fine. It's not a problem. There was, I think, two words in the entire collection I had a trouble with, and I asked one Rabbi Helfgott to help me and the other Rabbi Rakefet. The Hebrew handwriting is quite difficult, but I put it together, this nice selection of what I think it's 21 or so letters that we'll deal with, and one letter which was not included. I'll explain to you why they didn't include that as well. And I sent it to the Chakira. Chakira is the journal that comes out, which has become very, really a great journal. I think originally it was designed for more yeshivish people, but it's really more the modern Orthodox, because I guess the yeshivish people don't, for the most part, not entirely, but for the most part, are not interested in the things that the journal wants. And I sent it to them. And even though I had another piece on deck, I said, put this first and you can postpone my other piece. But no, they're actually in the next issue. I think my other piece is coming out too. So I published it, and it appeared, you can see it, it's on, I think it's online already now. If not, it's on my academia site, and it's, Letters from the Rav. Now, in dealing with the Rav, Rav Soloveitchik, there's a few different types of, I'm not going to say information, but output of the Rav that we have to keep in mind. First of all, there's material that he himself published and prepared for publication, or at least prepared for publication. There's essays that he wrote, and then volumes of halachic articles, which were included in volumes. The Shiurim was Zecher Abba Mari, which he was able to supervise, and Only Man of Faith. Halachic Mind, which he prepared, although it appeared after his death. Even the Halachic Man, the translation, was prepared under his supervision. And those are obviously the most significant, the most, if you're trying to judge Rav Soloveitchik, what his outlook is, his view on certain matters, that's the most important. And then we have public lectures and essays prepared for publication by other people. But these are public lectures, and maybe we have a transcript of that, or the Rav's notes, or even the Rav's actual text, because he would write out things. He'd write it out, often the speech he ad-libbed. So if you look, I'm going to give you an example in a few minutes of something where we have a tape of the Rav, and it's not identical to what he has written down. But basically, it's the same idea. And if we don't have tapes of it, we have that. And that was prepared. If the Rav was preparing for publication, he would have expanded in certain areas. But we don't have the Rav, so we have that. Then we have, I would say, letters. A lot of letters. Now, how are you going to judge the significance? We're going to see examples where there's contradictions. When you deal with someone like the Rav, who was teaching every day and speaking to people and sending letters, and you're trying to set up a, let's say, a portrait of him and what he believed, sometimes you're going to have contradictions. So you're going to have to judge the relative significance of the material. Obviously, what he himself wrote and published, that's the most important. Letters are not as important as that. And if someone writes, says something in a private letter, but says something publicly, I think we will assume that, at least in his public persona, that's his position. But the private letters are important because they show you the thinking behind the stage, as it were. And if you have a real contradiction between the private letter and the public statement, it could be that the private letter is actually more important. The public statement could be made for political reasons. The private letter could reflect personal sentiments that for one reason or another can't be made public. We'll see some examples of it. It's hard to know. The least, I think everyone would agree, though. So we'll have a debate over the significance of private letters versus public statements. This goes back to the issue of Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg also. What do you do when you have contradictions between the private letters I discovered and the public statements? But I think everyone would agree that what we call table talk, off-the-cuff comments, even in Shear, when he goes off, that is not as significant. It has to be put aside when faced with, let's say, private letters. Because when you write a letter, you think about it and you put your mind into it to say it. The same thing with a public statement, obviously, when you publish something. But what do I mean by the letters, the table talk statements? I mean a book like this, The Rav Thinking Aloud, Transcripts of Personal Conversations with Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Fascinating. But the Rav was like everyone else. He could have an offhand comment. I don't think that you need to pay it that much mind if it contradicts what we know about what the Rav said elsewhere. On the other hand, we have examples. For instance, his view of Yom HaTzmaut, you have here a 40-50 page transcript of a lengthy discussion to the Shear, in which he even responds to criticism from the students. That would obviously be more significant than off-the-cuff comments. I don't know if this book will be reprinted again. There was, although people like Rabbi Meiselman on the right wing were very happy with it, the mainstream followers of Soloveitchik were very upset with it. They didn't think this is the sort of thing that the Rav would want made public, even though some of the things they're upset about, he said with a huge tape recorder, not one of these little ones, one of these old-fashioned giant ones sitting right on his desk. He had to assume that that would be made public. But they reprinted a second edition where they took out a couple things, and I don't know if they'll reprint it again, but it was put out by David Holzer, or by David Holzer, who was a shamash, very close to the Rav. The Rav was very close to the Holzer family. The father, Emanuel Holzer, was one of the Rav's closest friends. So you can't, I spent all Pesach with the Holzers at the hotel I go to. You certainly can't accuse them of trying to create some Haredi image of the Rav or anything like that. So it's a complicated issue, which maybe we'll go into another time. In terms of the drushos of the Rav, I just want to share one thing with you before we begin. We have two volumes of Yiddish, thanks to David Fishman, Professor David Fishman of JTS, expert in East European Jewry and Yiddish. He put out this volume, Drushos und Ksavim, from, I forget the year already, 2017. And then in 2021, I think it is, or 2020, actually, hold on, it has an English title page, let me see. 2021, he put out this volume, Drushos Vegan Shiva Siyam and Kiyam HaUma, Drushos about return to Zion and the existence of our nation, all his religious Zionist talks. This picture, which I published on the Sfarim blog, I don't know if you can see it well here, you can see it on the Sfarim blog, it's a picture in a painting of the Rav in Rabbi Julius Berman's house. It's hanging. It's a huge painting. I went to interview him once, and I see this painting, and I said, can I take a picture of this? And then can I publish it? And he let me publish it. So if you want to see this amazing picture, now, I forget how he got it. Someone wanted to do a painting of the Rav. I don't think it was Berman. And then Berman asked, well, the Rav didn't know what to do with it. So I think that's the story. I forget the details. If some of you know Julius Berman, you could fill us in. And so it's hanging there. One of the drushos in this book, drushos from Kesavim, is the... first, let me tell you, you learned something interesting from the introduction, that one of the drushas here, a drush on tzedakah, was given to the workman's circle, the arbiter ring. This is not exactly a religious group, but the Rav gave that. Furthermore, he gave a drusha, one of the drushas we know he did, it's not here, but it's mentioned in the introduction that he gave a drusha was before Yivo. And on page 22 from the Farverts, Fishman quotes what they're saying here, how amazing it is that a grandson of Rav Chaim Brisker is speaking to us. Rav Chaim Brisker, who was so opposed to the who we are, you have a grandson of Rav Chaim Brisker. Rav Chaim Brisker's anacle had those unsuzagin. He's speaking to us. So that's amazing. But what you have here is the famous drasha of the Rav at Chinuch Atzmai. And we're going to speak about Chinuch Atzmai maybe today, because there's one of the letters. And then I'll speak about that there's a difference between the drasha here and what I'll show you that you can listen to online. But let's let me put this aside or hold it here. And let me, let's begin. By the way, I also one final point that I was a little nervous to publish this. It's not like Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, no family. Descendants to speak about, but the Rav Soloveitchik has. So I sent all the letters to Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, and he gave me permission, happily, to publish all this. I think it's the only time where, and I'm very grateful to Professor Soloveitchik. We had a nice correspondence where he reflected a little bit on some of what's there. So, these letters are authorized, if that means anything. okay, so let me begin. And what I'm going to do is just go through the letters, each letter, tell you about the background, what I find significant in the letters. And letters 1 through 3 are written to Rabbi Mordechai Kirschblum. Rabbi Mordechai Kirschblum was a religious Zionist leader in America. In 1952, he's head of Mizrahi. He's elected head of Mizrahi of America. So obviously, he's very close to Rav Soloveitchik. For those who don't know, Rav Soloveitchik was a member of the Agudas Yisrael. Not in Europe, but when he comes to America, he was even on the Meletzes Gedolei Torah in the late 30s. For those who don't believe it, I'll show you. It's in Hapardes. It actually gives the members of the Agudas Yisrael Moetzes Gedolei Torah, and although he's young, 35 years old, let's say 36, he was placed on it. But then after the Holocaust, probably during the Holocaust, his ideas begin to change. After the Holocaust, he identifies with Mizrahi. And he was the star speaker. I have some good pictures, which I found also, of the Rav speaking at the Mizrahi conventions. He was their star speaker. And so obviously in very close contact with Mordechai Kirschblum. Kirschblum was also appointed to the Jewish Agency executive. And in 1968, he moves to Israel, where he continues his religious Zionist activities. Now, the first letter is from 1956. And it already is going to complicate our portrait. The thing about the Rav is that he's a Zionist, but I hope I don't offend anyone by saying he's the most non-Zionist Zionist you can find. That is, whoever heard of a Zionist who never went to the State of Israel? I mean, it's whoever heard of a Zionist that everyone who told him that I want to go on Aliyah, he said, don't, we stay here. So, like, in theory, he's a great Zionist, and his writings are the most stirring calls to Zionism. And today they're standard texts in religious Zionist schools in Israel. But for a long time in the 60s and 70s, the attitude was he's not a real Zionist because he's not coming to live. He's not coming to live in Israel. And it's true. The Rav is not a Zionist the way we're often indoctrinated. Well, what defines a religious Zionist shul? The prayer for the state of Israel. Well, the Rav didn't believe in that. And certainly with Rav Kook and the move to Messianic Zionism is very far from the Rav. So a lot of the ideas that we assume are essential for religious Zionism, the Rav didn't share it. And you can see in Thinking Aloud, when the students of Yeshiva University did a special like Haftorah or Hallel service, I forget all the details, and Yom HaTzmaut, the Rav goes crazy and he can't handle it. And he's saying, this is nonsense. And nonsense, this is what the chief rabbinate says to do. This is what religious Zionist Gedolei Yisrael have said to do, a special prayer service. So the Rav is a different type of Zionist. And now, and we see, and could he have been? I mean, he had some hesitations. How could he not? His grandfather was Rav Chaim Brisker. If in the early 20th century, the two leading anti-Zionists were, one was the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Rashab, and the other was Rav Chaim Brisker. The stuff Rav Chaim Brisker said, you can't even be alone with a Zionist because we have to worry about, Sheikhus Damim, that they could kill you. And, I don't know whether he meant it literally or not, but the fact that he said it, Rav Chaim Brisker was as anti-Zionist as you can get, and not for theological reasons, like the Satmar, the three Shluos, no, because the Zionists are interested in uprooting traditional Judaism, we know all the reasons. So for the Rav, for someone from, and his uncle was like Naturi Karta, for someone, the Rav, with that Yichus, to become a Tzioni, to become a Zionist, that needs an explanation. That's why that's how he can hold. He's not going to say, I changed my mind. Who's he compared to his grandfather? If you know how he viewed his grandfather, he viewed him as the greatest Torah scholar. He had a Havana, he said, greater than the Vilna Gaon. So he could not say that I think my grandfather is wrong. What he said is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's the Joseph and his brothers, God himself decided for us. If it was just the Rabbanim, of course we have to follow Zaidi. But no, HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself paskins in this area that Mizrahi is correct. So if the Rav didn't have moments, and I think what you see in the Rav Thinking Aloud is these moments before he gets dressed and puts on his tie and goes out and presents himself the way he is, a religious Zionist, you can be sure that at nighttime when he's thinking, he has hesitations. He wonders, is this the proper path? And I think that's why these comments, these harsh comments that you see when he really lets his hair down and lets loose to the students, these non-Zionists, I won't say anti-Zionists, but he's definitely not. He sounds like he's Revaren Cutler coming out of Lakewood, some of these comments. I think that's what you're seeing a reflection of, not the thought-out positions of the Rav, but something that's deep down that he sublimates. And we see a little of this here. What's this first letter? Well, he mentions his daughter, Tova, 1956. I don't know Tova, but anyone, you could show her the letter, you can ask her. I'm sure she remembers. He says, I appreciate greatly your efforts on behalf of Tova and her friends. I was very disturbed and indignant when I received a phone call from Tova advising me that the LL people were trying to persuade her and other passengers to board the plane in London on Friday. So Tova and other American Orthodox youth, I don't know if she's a teenager then. I don't know when she's born, 56, if that's... Yeah, I think, so they don't know, but either a teenager or 20, whatever, when she's born. So they flew to London, and obviously there's a delay, and there's a problem here because the next leg of the flight is to Israel, and Elal was telling them that they should get the kids, the religious kids, get on the flight, and you'll make it for Shabbos, and Tova calls her father. And, you know, here you have Elal's official Israeli government at the time. It's not private. Telling people something, which of course is going to lead to Chilal Shabbos. And this annoys the Rav to no end. Quote, I resented the deliberate attempt on the part of LL officials to mislead a group of sincere boys and girls and to place them in a precarious position in which they would have been compelled to violate the Shabbos. So we see from this that they didn't violate it. Obviously, they didn't. Maybe the Rav probably said, don't listen to them. And someone can ask Tova, what happened? Maybe they flew Sunday, whatever it is. And the Rav says the LL officials knew very well that it was impossible for a plane which is supposed to take off from the London airfield on Friday noontime to land in Lida, Israel, before sunset. You know, Lida, that's before Ben-Gurion Airport. It's Lod Airport. Nevertheless, they kept on asserting that such a miracle of Kfitzas HaDerech was possible and quite probable. And they repeatedly assured, he said, the people that it would land in time. By the way, this letter, this letter I found in the Central Zionist Archives in Israel. So I went to the Central Zionist Archives. I sat there for a long, long time. They're not online yet, and I found it. So, and then he says, what is it at the end of this paragraph? Such false predictions reflect a cynical and brutal disregard for religious values, which is so characteristic of the officialdom in Israel. It's hard for us to imagine today when you walk through Jerusalem. I was in Jerusalem a few weeks ago. I mean, you walk in Jerusalem, it's like it's not true. I don't know if it's half but there's certainly many people in Jerusalem who are not Shomer Shabbos. And they created now the first station, and you see Friday night. But sometimes when you're walking in Jerusalem, you get the sense that everyone is religious there. And it's but in the 50s, yarmulkes would be not just in the minority, it would be hard to find yarmulkes. I already mentioned that religious people working for the government felt they had to remove their yarmulkes. To have religious people in the army, look who now is just appointed chief of staff, a nephew of Rav Kook, great nephew of Rav Kook. And religious people were in all high positions in police, in army. I mean, this would have been unimaginable in the 50s. And we all know what the officials of the labor government, what they were doing for the people who went on Aliyah, what they were doing with the Yemenites and the Sfardim. And so obviously things have changed a great deal. We have to put ourselves back into the 1950s. And now just after blasting what's going on in the state of Israel with the officialdom and with El Al, the Rav says as follows to Kirschbaum. Now remember, the Rav is head of Mizrahi here. This did not stop him, as we'll see, from publicly clashing with Israel. We'll see later about the shipping line and other things. The Rav could clash publicly with Israel. But some of the things, I don't know if he'd say publicly. He says to Kirschbaum that, you know my emotional and intellectual involvement in the sacred cause of Shivat Zion. That's what makes the Rav Zionist. The idea that we return to Zion, we're called to return. And he says, my relationship to the state of Israel, he sees it as a miraculous grant of infinite divine grace to a martyred, abused, and persecuted people. He's saying to him, you know that I think the state of Israel is the greatest gift that God has given us. Elsewhere, the Rav says that if not for the state of Israel, the Jewish people, it just would have led to complete assimilation. Because after the destruction of the Holocaust, there was nothing there for us. We needed this. We needed God to give us. And he says that you're also aware that whenever zealots and bigots try to create imaginary religious issues, and he says, and I felt that they were doing this because of hatred for the state of Israel, I stood up and protested. He's referring here to Satmar and people in the yeshiva world today, what we call the Haredi world. But Satmar in particular, Satmar would have protests. There were protests over the swimming pool in Jerusalem, over girls, are they going to draft girls to the army or not? And Satmar and the non-Jews have blood on their hands. This is 10 years after the Holocaust. And Satmar is having these giant rallies the Rav refers to them as zealots and bigots, and it's unfair the way they're describing what's going on in Israel. And the Rav says, I stand up for it. But then the Rav says, because of this, because I have been so out there defending the state of Israel against the people who unfairly criticize it, he says, that's why when I feel I encounter irresponsible conduct and willful interference by irreligious officials that affect the religious conscience, he says, doubts of a very unpleasant nature begin to assail my head. He says, and willy-nilly, I question myself whether I am always right in refusing to give credence to the slanderous rumors circulated by the extremists. So he says here, first of all, this word willy-nilly. Zarov came to this word, and he loved this word. He would repeat this word a lot. But he says that, even me, such a great defender of the state of Israel, when I encounter what I just encountered, I begin to wonder, doubts, he says, assail my head. Am I always right when I come out against Satmar and come out against the right-wing yeshiva circles when they're attacking the state of Israel for this and that? And maybe they're right. Maybe I shouldn't be defending the state of Israel just intuitively and saying, oh, it has to be wrong. Because now I see, with my own eyes, we see that an arm of the Israeli government, if they had its ways, would have put these kids on the plane and forced them to be Mechallel Shabbos. And then they're going to show up at 8 o'clock, it's already Shabbos. Then what are they going to do? They're going to put them on buses. And, you know, you see what's going to happen here. He says, cannot the Jewish agency understand once and for all that the thousands of young boys and girls born and reared in the U.S., religion means a great deal more than mere ceremony? These officials in Israel, they think that, religion's going to be gone soon, and it's something for the old people. And if you see the young people with it, we have to try to uproot this, these phony superstitions. He says that these people, these secularists in Israel, don't realize that we have committed young Orthodox Jews in America who are, quote, ready to forgo many activities for the sake of complying with the law, the Torah. He says they've observed Shabbos when they were in school, sometimes a great sacrifice, and they are not going to forsake the sacred principle because of a trip to Israel. Not even Ben Gurion, with his illiterate philosophy of Judaism, will succeed in changing their mode of living. So, I mean, these are strong words, and even stronger from the head of the honorary head of Mizrahi in America, saying that we can't take this anymore and we can't cover this up, that we can't make believe that these officials are not trying to uproot Torah in our young people. It's bad enough in the old people, but in the young people, that's where the battle always is. It's the young people and the leaders. The Zionist leaders understood that if you capture the young, you'll capture the future. I mean, the idea that today we'd have such religion in the state of Israel, this would have been incomprehensible to them in the 50s. And then he continues, he congratulates him from his new post at the Department of Religious Culture of the Jewish Agency. There used to be, I don't know if it still exists, a Department of Religious Culture. And they published important volumes. It's Zvi Yaron's it's really the first book on the philosophy of Rav Kook was published in English by this Department of Religious Culture. BMT, my alma mater, Beis Medrash Torah, as Rav Heffet never tires of saying, the first institution, Torah institution in the state of Israel directed toward the Anglo-Saxon world. That was funded by the Department of Religious Culture of the Jewish Agency. Now, that's the letter, the first letter. And in the note, I'll bring it to you next week because Rabbi Beryl Wine, I don't remember 100% the details. I want to have it in front of me. Beryl Wine wrote a memoir called Teach Them Diligently, and I didn't get a chance to get it, but I'll get it for next class. He also gives an example where El Al did not follow Halacha and the Rav's response. That was always issues like in the 70s, as I recall, you know, flying on Shabbos, not flying on Shabbos, but that's a different issue. Here, the Rav's speaking about what he sees as an attempt of irreligious coercion. They speak a lot about religious coercion, but there's also irreligious coercion. Ritz Yehuda Cook was you can't get more Zionist than Ritz Yehuda Cook. He was a member of the Society Against Religious Coercion in Israel because he believed that the only way to bring the non-religious close was not by coercing them. When I say coercion, though, he didn't mean that he had a different understanding of coercion because he didn't say, therefore, you shouldn't have the Rabbanut controlling marriage and divorce. They didn't believe in allowing buses to run on Shabbos, but he had his own, he had a much more limited coercion. But as Ritz Yehuda and many others never tired of pointing out, if we say that we're against religious coercion, then you should be against irreligious coercion. There always was a lot of irreligious coercion in Israel also, and it pains me to say it. But if you know the history, you know that when the Aliyat Noar, when they brought over especially the kids from Morocco and the people from Yemen, there was an effort there to indoctrinate them into irreligiosity. And that's just a fact. And that was battled. The religious parties battled about this, and governments fell, you know, on this. But this goes back already to the 40s, to the Tehran, when the kids who were survivors of the Holocaust who made their way to Tehran, and then they were brought to Palestine. The deal that was made between the chief rabbinate and the religious parties and the Jewish agency was that kids from religious families would be placed with religious homes. And kids from irreligious families in Europe would go to irreligious homes. And lo and behold, they discovered that kids who in Europe and who are now rescued, who came from religious families, were being placed in irreligious kibbutzim. And that was a big controversy. So that's letter number one. We'll go another 10 minutes or so to take the questions. The second letter, I put all the letters to Rabbi Kirschbaum together. In fact, these two letters, the first one is July 12th, 1956, and the second is July 13th, the very next day. And he says, after I wrote you the letter, I forgot to mention this. He also has the Hebrew date on top of the of both of the letters. But notice the Rav has no problem putting in the English date. There are some people who won't write the secular date, or if they do, they'll say July 13th. They won't say 1956. They'll have a little apostrophe. They'll say 56 or something like that. And there are sources that speak about this, halachic sources, but the accepted approach is that there's no problem here. It's contrary to what people think. Some of the people who oppose it say, well, this dates from Jesus's birth. Well, it really doesn't. Jesus, we know, was born maybe 4 BCE. So yeah, they gave that as the date, but we know he wasn't, and it's it really has no significance in people's mind in that respect. So. And you see Maisa Rav, the Rav putting the date. Now, the second letter is, he says, I wrote to you last night, but I forgot to mention that I was very annoyed by the telegrams from the chief rabbinate. It's the Rav had a love-hate relationship with the chief rabbinate of Israel. On the one hand, he himself was asked to be chief rabbi. And he turned it down because he explained that the position is one of where you're subject to all sorts of pressures by the government. And in 1935, he wanted to be chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. After that, after Rav Herzog passed away, they wanted him very much to be chief rabbi. They would have given it to him. Well, we're going to get to it. I'll show you the telegram later on. But the Rav turned it down. On the other hand, the Rav always gave great respect to the holders of chief rabbinate, and he understood correctly that because the idea that you'd have separation of church and state was separation of synagogue and state was not something the Rav held, that you need a strong chief rabbinate, because as long as there is no separation of synagogue and state, you need to have Talmidei Chachamim in charge of the chief rabbinate, of the Batei Din. And remember, in Rav Soloveitchik's time, it's not like today. Today, there doesn't seem to be any assumption that the chief rabbis have to be Gedol Yisrael. And we've seen that they've elected people who are not Gedol Yisrael. They could be fine rabbis, but not Gedol Yisrael of the sort that we speak of. But in the days, at least until relatively recently, it was thought that the chief rabbi would be, if not the greatest, one of the greatest Gedolim in the religious Zionist world. And you had that. You had Rav Cook, you had Rav Herzog, you had Rav Unterman, Rav Gorin, even Rav Avram Shapiro. These were Gedol Yisrael. But the chief rabbinate, precisely because of what the Rav says, that it's forced to succumb to certain pressures, or felt it's forced to succumb from the government, that's why that annoyed Soloveitchik to no end. He says in this letter, I don't know what the issue is, but he says, I resent the delaying tactics and maneuvers practiced by the members of this great and venerable institution. There was some halachic issue. He says, it took my brother, that's Rav Aharon, exactly several hours to arrive at definite conclusions and offer voluntarily advice and guidance to young people who are perplexed and confused. Now, I don't think it's referring to the issue, maybe it is, that they were stuck in London. Because the Tova calls the Rav. The Rav would tell her what to do. He's going to say, call my brother. He'll tell you what to do. And you'd have telegrams with the chief rabbinate. It doesn't make sense. I think this is some other issue, that there was an issue where they needed guidance. Maybe it was religious Zionist kids going to Israel. They needed guidance from the chief rabbinate. Maybe it's Yom Tov Sheni. Maybe it's that they're being put at certain kibbutzim that have kashrus issues. Whatever it is, he says the chief rabbinate is hemming and hawing and not doing anything. They're afraid to make a decision. And he says, my brother, he gave them guidance. And in a few hours of hearing all the issues here and investigation, he was able to give them clear-cut guidance. He says, why should the rabbinate, whose duty it is to render clear-cut decisions, debate the issue for weeks and months and attempt to evade responsibility? Oh, so we see from here it's not the issue of Tova's issue, because he's talking about something that's been going on for months that you can't get a word from the chief rabbinate. They say, well, we have to think about it. We'll get back to you, that sort of thing. And he says that, listen to this. In the future, I am not going to cooperate with the chief rabbinate, since it is beset by fears and ludicrous cowardice. And from time to time, he says, engages in hypocrisy. He says that I, too, can wrap myself in the mantle of a saint, in quotes, and a kanai, a zealot, and let myself be proclaimed a tzaddik. In other words, he's saying that the members of the chief rabbinate, they're afraid that they're going to be attacked. If they give a halachic decision, someone's going to attack them, and they're worried, they're looking over the shoulders. And the Rav says that I, too, can claim to be a saint and a kanai and not give a decision. And no one's going to attack me then. But that's not their responsibility. Their responsibility, they were given this position, and they have to make the decision. And if making the decision means that people on the right are going to attack them, well, then that's their responsibility. And he goes on criticizing the chief rabbinate. Harsh criticism, which he would not have made public. He would not have ever spoken about this at a Mizrahi convention, because it's very, very harsh criticism. And look, let's be honest, the chief rabbinate, even when, and we're talking about an era of Herzog and Nissen, really Gedolius role there, but there were problems. There's always going to be problems when you have a rabbinate that's being pressured a great deal. And Rav Herzog, who was a gadol of enormous, massive proportions, we know that he was afraid to come out with decisions. He was very afraid of the response of the Haredim, and he was very nervous about that. He valued his connections in the Haredi world, and he punted on many occasions and didn't really take a stand on issues, which if you don't take a stand, you're taking a stand, because things are going to develop a certain way. Now, the last part of the letter, the last paragraph, is interesting in a different respect. Remember, I told you Kirschblum was appointed head of this Department of Religious Culture, and he says to him that, you know, I hope you can put it on a solid educational basis. And the Rav tells him you should offer courses. And what type of courses? He says you should integrate. It's amazing to think about it today, because this never would have happened. Integrate the Department of Religious Culture into a program of an existing graduate school and conduct it in the same manner, for example, that Harvard with regard to its Russian or Middle Eastern Institute. So he's saying that the Department of Religious Culture should maybe be set up in Colombia. Colombia should have an institute for the study of religious Zionism or something. The Rav is trying to create like a real intellectual institute where the issues are studied on the highest level. That never would have happened. And it wasn't even, as we say, a havamin, a thought to the people running it. But it's, look what the Rav is thinking about. He's thinking really, really high. And then he says, I believe that the Yeshiva University will be glad to cooperate with you. And he says, don't just have lectures from time to time. You can do that. But he says you should have an institute, publish a periodical dealing with religious, philosophical, popular halachic topics, which have a bearing on our statehood problematics. This would enhance the prestige of our movement. And he goes on. But he says that it would disseminate knowledge among the cultured laity, and I'm willing to cooperate with you. Provided, he says, the work will be organized along these lines. The Rav says, I'll cooperate, but you have to organize it on a high level, something I feel is going to make a real contribution. And they never did. And I think it would have been impossible to, because that's not what it was about. It was more about educating younger people. And although they did publish, as I said, some works, they did publish some booklets and pamphlets, but never an institute in a high level. Like, basically, he's asking for like an Orthodox forum sort of institution. So with this, I see it's already 9:25. So we see the two letters. Oh, he signs, by the way, his name. Sincerely yours, Jay Soloveitchik. In the first letter, it's Joseph Soloveitchik. When we get to the Hebrew names, it's interesting. You'll see some things. We're actually going to skip letter three, and we'll pick up next week with letter four, Chinuch Atzmai. How is it that a Mizrahiite becomes the big fundraiser for the Aguda Chinuch Atzmai and gives one of his greatest speeches that, but we'll get to that. I can play you some of it as well. Let me take some of the comments here. Thank you all for those who are new. Thank you for joining us. Now I know what Yosef felt when the Sarah Mashkin forgotten. Yes. And I hope Rabbi Yellen, I don't know if you had a chance to hear last class where I dealt with that issue we've been discussing through emails. Bina says, you say everyone trusted them. Please define everyone. Would Rav Moshe have gone to the pioneer? All I can say is, listen to the class last week. Not only would Rav Moshe have gone to the pioneer, Rav Moshe's granddaughter's wedding was at the pioneer. And Rav Moshe always went there for sukkahs. As we heard last class, the Aguda convention was there. The Aguda Yisrael would have their conventions there. And so everyone went there. And Rabbi Yellen said that's where they used to do the shidduchim. So, yes, I know it's hard for people today to grasp this, but I can tell you that Simcha by the Sea, as I've said, but we have new people. I did the Sheva Brachos, the Rav Reuven Feinstein's daughter. I was the waiter. Rav Aaron Cutler's wife came every single Shabbos, and Rebbetzin Schwartzman, Rav Aaron's daughter. And so once I was there one Shabbos, Rav Dov Schwartzman, and Rebbetzin Schwartzman were there the same weekend. You know, they're divorced, but they were there the same weekend. So I talked in learning that whole Shabbos with Rav Dov Schwartzman. No hashgacha on the place, never. But that was the olden days.
Thank you. I love it.
Okay. And Rabbi Yellen says, yes, Rav Moshe did, certainly. Doesn't New York State have a kosher law? It had a kosher law and it has a kosher law. But that doesn't mean any mashgiach. They have their own mashgiach. The mashgiach is, I have a relative, my wife's relative, and we went to a shiva house. And they're not religious, but they had stuff there, so I didn't know if it's kosher. So I said, we got it from so-and-so. I don't know, Long Island. So I asked him, I said, is there a Zadar Shkach? He says, yes, New York Department of Agriculture. That's the Shkach. That he says it's kosher because once in a blue moon, the Department of Agriculture. So there is. But we know that if you really take kosher seriously, you can't trust that. And that actually was found unconstitutional in New Jersey. They got rid of I think in New York also, they might have gotten rid of that. I think there was that place in Conak, New York, I think, where they had conservative hashgacha and the Orthodox rabbi didn't, the Orthodox people running the Department of Agriculture section kept giving them fines. So I know it went to court, but that's not, yes, New York State will say, but that doesn't mean you need to have mashgiach there of the sort that we have.
Rabbi Shapiro?
Yeah, hold on a second. Let me, yes, go on. Sorry. Yes.
To go back to the Rav, in 1954, the first Machon Kayetz, which I had the pleasure of going in. And when I came back on Rosh Hashanah, I was a member of the Belgian community. That was the Maria Shul, where the Rav was the rabbi at the time. And he, after davening, his famous finger went like this to me. And he told me to come up to his apartment in the afternoon. He wanted to fahear me about Israel. And outside the door before I went in, Tova was sitting there and said, Nikki, make it good. I want to go. So I said, okay. And He was extraordinarily interested. He wanted to know exactly what I saw, what I thought, how I felt about it. And you should know, during the our families were quite close. And at the time when he was supposed to be the chief rabbi, everybody in our community begged him not to do it because we felt he would get slaughtered, and it was beneath his dignity. One of the reasons he never went was he felt that if he went, he could never leave. And so he wanted to know for sure that he was going to go before he would, take that kind of trip.
Thank you very much. For those who don't know, the Maria Shul is where the Rav would also give shiur during the week, and he would come on different Shabbosim. Some people have speculated that it's precisely because of his experience in 1935 that he was then reluctant to throw his hat in the ring. And in terms of visiting, it's also said that if he went there, he would have had to go to Heichal Shlomo. He'd have to give kavod to the chief rabbis. After all, he's coming as the head of the Mizrahi. And the problem was that his uncle, Rav Elvel, they put a cherem on Heichal Shlomo. You can't step foot in there. So how can, and he's very close to his uncle from his youth. How can he then, he couldn't go to Israel without going to the chief rabbis Heichal Shlomo, but he couldn't go to Heichal Shlomo because his uncle put it in a cherem. So it seems, but many times he said he's going. We'll get to this next class or the class after. He said, I'm coming this summer, I'm coming next summer. He was going to go with his wife. They built, when Gruss, the whole idea of Gruss was that Gruss gave the money for the Gruss Institute, which is then where BMT was and now Torah Shraga. The agreement was Gruss gave the money on the Tanai, on the assumption, they made an actual agreement that the Rav would come there for 6 months to give shiur one semester. So we'll get back to all these things. Someone says, Ben, that the COR, I guess that's in Canada, that they made every food store downtown take down any signs written in Hebrew. So people would be, people would be confused, I guess, if they saw it. Yeah. Yeah. You want to say one more thing?
One other thing is his wife at that point in the 50s was quite sick. There were times when she was in the hospital and back. I think that figured very strongly into his, I remember my brother blowing shofar for her because she couldn't even make it to shul.
On the other hand, he doesn't even go after her passing. He doesn't go when he keeps saying he's going to go and he doesn't go. And there seems to be, there was some fear or something keeping him from going. Look, Belkin never went either, which is
a
strange.
Man,
why you opened
gone.
Up a place there? It's hard to imagine. Rav Moshe did go, but Rav Moshe only went, for the Aguda convention. He did not go after 67 when there was a kotel there. And, so it's hard for us to imagine, why it's a great mystery, why the Rav never was able to bring himself to go. And we'll get back to that because I think, I'll speak, more about that. Jacob says that Thinking Aloud is available for sale. You can get a copy at the Y.U. Sfarim sale, but you need to check. I think it's the second edition, the edition where they censored some material in it. But yeah, it's for sale. You can, the Holzers have a website where you can get not just Thinking Aloud. They did, I think it's 3 or 4 volumes on Chumash they put out, a very nice material there. And also one of the sons of, Rabbi David Holzer is an expert in publishing Rishonim. And also David Holzer and one of his sons published this beautiful Haggadah with pictures, medieval manuscript with pictures. So there's a lot of good stuff. I think it's holzersfarim.com or something like that. David Holzer also, he's a chemist with patents. I mean, a brilliant family. David Eisen says, I assume the painting in Julius Berman's home was prepared from a photo as opposed to the Rav posing for the painting. You know, I'm going to get to the answer to this because I think otherwise. I think the Rav posed. I think his wife wanted him to do it. But I will ask because I don't remember, but I'll get the answer for next class. And I'll share it. Preserve it for posterity. Gershon says, Rabbi Kirschbaum frequently visited my home in Golders Green and used to write extremely mellifluous letters to my mother, thank you for hospitality, a very friendly man. And David says, Rabbi Rakefet claims that the Rav indeed planned to make Aliyah, and these were rescinded when his wife passed away, as he was unable to come in Aliyah as a widower. Yeah. Look, obviously, if you speak to Tova, she'll tell you probably about conversations they had with her. All I know is that we have many examples where the Rav said, I plan on coming. In print, he says, and we have letters where he says, I plan on coming, let's say, this summer, and it didn't happen. And Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg also. Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, they sent him airline tickets in the 50s. Everything was paid for. All he has to do is get to Zurich and get on the plane. And he says he's going. And he said it. He kept saying, I'm coming. And then he didn't go. And then they did it again and again. And then they stopped taking him seriously. He said, how could Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, also a big Zionist? And yet he couldn't bring himself he was more of a Zionist than the Rav in certain respects, because he spoke of it as like an assault to the Geula, and it's a mystery. David says, did the Rav have any correspondence or interaction with Yoel Teitelbaum? I have never heard of any interaction. Rav Moshe did. And we have a Talmud looking right at me of Rav Tuvia Goldstein. And if you read the biography of Rav Tuvia Goldstein, where you'll see this Talmud's picture in it, they talk about Rav Tuvia Goldstein was the shliach, or the go-between, between Rav Moshe and the Satmar Rebbe, because, the Satmar basically, they only watched Purim and Chayram after the AI artificial insemination decision, and they were going crazy, so they tried to have some shalom by meeting, and Rav Moshe was supposed to meet with the Satmar Rebbe, but in the end it didn't happen. I've never heard of any connection whatsoever. And look, if you take what the Satmar Rebbe writes literally, I don't know how literally you take it, but if you take what he writes literally, the Rav is an apikoros, like every other Zionist, he's an apikoros. The Rav did not have positive things to say about what he called the Williamsburg mentality. Ben says, isn't there a financial cost to send half empty planes to Israel borne by the taxpayers? I guess there is. I don't know what, I don't know if the planes were empty or not. I have a guy in my department, University of Scranton. He's not Jewish, but he goes to Israel a lot because he does stuff about Jewish Christian relations. And I asked him, because he's flown Friday night. You can fly Friday night or Shabbos. It's a very different flight. Can you imagine? No religious Jews on it. I'm sure there's a lot more empty seats, but I bet you there's also people, Israelis, who dafka choose to go on Friday night, because then they don't have to put up with, maybe the minyanim or things like that. I'd love to have a camera to see what it looked like, the Friday night flight. But I don't know if those flights are full or not full, but he told me that they're not empty. Nissen says only Judaic scholars use CE as common era, as in BC. That's not true, Nissen. Today, that's the politically correct term to use, that everyone in the academic world uses CE and BCE, because that's the neutral term. So no one in no academic work or newspaper will write AD or BC. AD Anno Domini, Year of Our Lord. Yes, and David says that the letters to the Kirschblum were written during the 9 days. Well, some people don't like to travel in the 9 days, but everyone assumes that if you're going to Eretz Yisrael, you can travel in the 9 days. And I've traveled all over the world during the 9 days. I was in Hungary in the 9 days last year, and a whole group of Hasidim were there. They were going to some kever right in western Ukraine. So there's technically no problem traveling, although some people don't like to, but there's no sources really that say that you can't fly in an airplane during the 9 days. Yes, Mel says you're right. The letters, he calls it Bein HaMetzarim. I'm not coming to Borough Park on Shabbos. My son and his friend are coming. And you want to know, I kept telling my son, I took him to Borough Park, showed him around. It's interesting to see if you've never seen it. And he kept saying he wants to go. And then the commentator, the YU commentator, the current issue, there's a whole story there about a student who was driving, and then his car broke down and he couldn't make it to where he was going to go. So he was near Kiryas Yoel. So he went to Kiryas Yoel, and he had a wonderful welcome, and he went back And he wrote a whole piece about it. And then my son said, you know, now it's a good, I should have the experience also. The person he's staying with is a good friend of mine, or he's eating with a wonderful person who I think is going to have a very good influence on them. Because people in the modern Orthodox world, when I was young, I used to go to Borough Park for Shabbatons. I went to the Baba Rebbe's Tish. I did all these things I did already in elementary school. I would never let my kid in fifth grade. We would go by ourselves, Shabbaton, it was called Jep. And we'd walk around ourselves, parents didn't have a problem with it. But I even went to Satmar. I walked in the Satmar shul, and, you know, people think of Satmar, they're not nice to you, this, and I can tell you, Edut Nemana, I walked in as a ninth grader, looking the way I did, into a Satmar shul. Everyone was so friendly, and I ended up going. I used to go to Borough Park and only eat at the house I was at Friday night, knowing I can walk into any shul and someone would invite me. So I've had only the greatest Achnasas Orachim, not just in Satmar Borough Park, but in Kiryas Yoel and other places. So, it's important for people to see that. Yes, Hadassah Kamak, Ben's Deli. A couple more things before we end. Rabbi Sachs, Joan Sachs tells us the prosecutor's office in Philadelphia had a person who would check whether those who claimed the food business kosher was telling the truth. Listen, this goes back in New York. This goes back to the turn of the 20th century. They had these officers. I guess if you leave out the constitutional issues, I guess it's a good thing because, the more people checking for kosher is good, but the fact is that we cannot rely on this. This is not considered a reliable hashkacha, the state of New York, even if it's an Orthodox rabbi, because what do they come? They'll come once every 6 months, and that's not, but this goes way back in New York. They had this. Thank you all. Rabbi Kelvin, we have a big crowd tonight, so I'm glad we were
very helpful. Tolga Lichtenstein is an extraordinary human being, and she's a friend of mine. I've never met her. It's well worth spending some time with her. And
by the way, Zev Elif did a video with her because he wrote a piece on what would have happened had, you know, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein stayed in America, like a counterfact historical piece. And he did a whole hour with Tova discussing, and you get a sense in her understanding of American Orthodoxy, why they went to Israel, how things changed, yeah, things with her father. So very interesting.
I guide you to that source, and I'll leave you in peace.
Yes, thank you. And one finally, Aaron Adler says that LL doesn't fly on Shabbos. LL now is a private company owned by a religious family, and they will do their utmost to avoid Chilul Shabbos. And his son, Eitan Adler, is a religious pilot for LL. Keep on all shkoyach on that. That means I know another religious pilot, or I met another religious pilot, not on LL. So I can now testify to two Shomer Shabbos pilots that I know of, and I'm sure there are many others. So,
Dr. Mark, I didn't realize now, but that's, of course, Rabbi Adler, who was the Shamash of the Rabbi living in Israel for many years, who wrote the book 70 Conversations.
Is that who's listening to us
yes,
right
that's
now?
Yes, that's because well, I know okay, his son. Well, then, I know his son is the pilot for LL.
I should say Rabbi He's Aaron Adler, before, so. Who, look, my
Rabbi Adler, my you can say hello if you want to unmute yourself.
Is literary, although I was, I did help drive the Rav the last year, but Aaron Adler, and I can say to Rabbi Adler that next article in Hakira, I do quote a piece from your book, from one of your conversations with the Rav, and I recommended that book to everyone. And Rabbi Adler and I know each other for many years by email, and we've met once or twice. So I thank you very much. And he didn't identify himself, but thank you, Rabbi Hellman, for identifying in the presence of someone who knew the Rav very well. And not only that, everyone is thankful because of his recent book in which he records those numerous conversations he had with the Rav, which are the sort of table talk that I mentioned, but so enlightening. And thank you, Rabbi Adler. I it's in Israel now. So I know David Isaac
America
gets
now
up,
for a few months.
If you're in America, maybe that explains it. Thank you.
You are in Israel, Rabbi. I will
it's
say
one quarter to five in the morning.
Okay, you see, he got up early. But I will say, a few months before COVID struck, we had Rabbi Adler, the pleasure of having him in our house here in Toronto. And he gave a talk. It was actually at my sister's house for Shabbos. But we gave a talk. He gave a talk Friday night, so it's not recorded. And when it was meant to be, I don't know, 25 minutes. It was like an hour and 45 minutes talking about stories of the Rav. And I told him at the time, we really have to get him to do this online. It was such a fascinating talk. Just all the personal connection, because he was the shamash of the Rav for a number of years. Rabbi Adler, I'm just maybe one time we'll get you to sort of.
But you know that they all have great stories. Holzer has great stories. Chaim Jachter has great stories. I mean, these people had a big zechus that they were able to be close to the Rav. That, look, I drove the Rav with Chaim Jachter just in Boston, the Kollel. So, I mean, I just had a couple of these interactions. But the people who were able to get close to the Rav, especially in his younger years, it's a life-changing thing, and I'm jealous of them.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Okay, we look forward to next week. Just if I can, a couple other announcements outside of the Rav now, just to let people know. I'll start with something that nobody knows because it was just finalized like 5 hours ago and not published. But starting next Thursday, I believe, a week from this Thursday, Rabbi Adam Mintz will be giving a 4-part series. He just came out with a book on the history of Eruvin. That was his, you know, PhD. Rabbi Mintz is going to give a 4-part series of the history of Eruvin in North America, including one on the Toronto Eruv, of course, which is a very interesting.
Wait, let me just tell you, I've seen the book because I was in Dubai, and guess who was serving as the rabbi for a few weeks in Dubai just 3 weeks ago? Rabbi Adam Mintz.
So that will be.
We'll brought the book with him.
And tomorrow at 11 a.m., Dr. Moshe Sokolow is back after a while. Rabbi Adler, you might be interested to know, he'll be talking about the songs of the Chalutzim, an analysis of songs of the Chalutzim. We haven't put an end date to that. That's going to be sort of ongoing. We'll see. That's tomorrow at 11 a.m. And then we have all our regular shiurim, but Rabbi Helfgott is not speaking this week, Wednesday night, but all the regular shiurim and Parsha Shir is Rabbi Daniel Friedman of the Teaneck Jewish Center. We're giving the Parsha Shir Thursday and regular shiurim during the week. So, and Rabbi Liebtag will be starting a new series on Sunday on chronology in the Torah. All the debates about when the Torah is and isn't, and depending according to who in chronological order. So we look forward to learning with you. And please bring invite a friend, and always open to ideas and suggestions. And we like to hear from you. And thank you very much. And everybody have a wonderful night.
Will Yossi Levin be giving the butter?
Yeah. No, Yossi Levin speaking, and I'm giving my class on the Siddur, and Rabbi Schulman's giving a class on the. I didn't mention all the regular shiur we have. Yeah, everything. Just mentioned Rabbi Helfgott's not giving his shiur this week. This week and next week, he won't be giving the shiur 2 weeks off. But we'll have all our regular shiur. Yeah, so we send them reminders before, but just to let everybody know. Okay, look forward to seeing you and learning with you all soon. And everybody have a Laila Tov, and thank you very much.
Laila
Tov. Hi,
Nikki.
Thank you. This was fantastic.
Okay, everybody.
Ashir Koloch, thank you so, so much.
Okay, I think Dr. Mark left, but I'll pass along the thanks. And thank you. Thank you for joining us. Okay.